Ist immer ein Mensch.
Wow. Ja, das ist immer bei euch ist auch Skippeljump.
Well, we're really glad that you are here. Francis, thanks so much for joining us for 25 hours.
Thank you.
Really amazing.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We'll have it soon.
It's a treat. I'm already going to do an intro about myself. I'm going to read a story. But there's some things you need to know before I start reading the story. This is a true story, and it was archived by a shanaki or a storyteller called Eddie Manahan. It takes place a few kilometers from where I grew up, in a village called Tulla in East Clare. And here are some phrases that you need to know before I start. Other crowd means fairies. The good people mean fairies. Fairy means fairies, but you would never call a fairy, it could be taken the wrong way. So this is a story called The Transaction with the Other Crowd. There were several big horse fairs in Ireland long ago, like Ballinasloe in Galway, Cahir and Meath Cork, but the biggest of them all was here in Clare, in Spansel Hill. It was a 3-day affair, and the British Army even used to come to buy horses there. That's how important it was. And it's still going on, but there's only one day for it now. For a while there, about 20 years ago, they thought it wouldn't last at all, but it did, and it's still going strong now. But wait till I tell you about what happened to a man living only about 10 miles up there from one time. He's going to the same fair. It was during the landlord's time. And this man was from the above parish in Tulla. Brian O'Rourke was his name. A married man, a farmer, an honest man too, trying to make ends meet any way he could, like the rest of the neighbors. And it wasn't easy to do that with the farm they had. Most of it was only rushes and bog. Whatever way they worked, himself and his wife, they were always only one step ahead of the hunger. At that time, the rent used to have to be paid twice a year, on the gale day, April and October, or June and December. It used to vary from place to place, but for Brian, it was in June. So the gale day was coming up, anyway, and he says to his wife, Moira, what'll we do? They hadn't the money. And if they faced the landlord's agent with their hands hanging to him, well, you know what would happen. They could be thrown out on the road, and if he was in bad humor that same day, we'll have to sell the horse, says he. Sure, that's no kind of talk. If we sell the horse, how'll we manage? And 'twas true for her, of course. If there was no horse, who was going to do the plowing and the rest of the work? Him or her? What'll we do, so? They argued out, and there was nothing to be done. 'Twas either the horse that had to go or themselves. So he says to Moira, call me early in the morning, and I'll get what I can from below at Spansel Hill. I can do no more than that. So she did. Called him up at the break of day and he hit off. You know yourself now, 'tis about 6 miles from the upper end of Tulla's parish down to Spansel Hill. Well, he was making good time, going along there below Tulla, there where the bit of the castle is at Lissafin. 'Twas well day at this stage. When all of a sudden, the horse reared up and nearly threw him. By God, he held on, somehow. And when he quieted him again, he looked down to see what it was that made him shy. Maybe a rat, or a badger, or something like that. He got the fright of his life, because there on the road, looking up at him, was a small little man, oh, maybe 2 foot high, a look of poison in his face. O'Rourke, says he, get down off that horse. Were you trying to trample me, or what? Sure, Brian was looking at him, stupid, with his mouth open. Get down, says he, or I'll make you get down. So Brian got off his horse and faced him on the road. I'm sorry, says he. I never even saw you. I was half sleeping. All right, says the little lad, but tell me this. Where are you going with that grand horse? To the fair Spansel Hill, sir, says Brian. And I wouldn't be going there, only I have to. The rent is due and we haven't the money to pay it. The horse is our only hope. And tell me now, how much do you expect to get for him at that fair? 7 or 8 pounds, I hope, says Brian, if I'm lucky. Ha! The small man laughed at him. Why would you give away a fine horse like that for £8? I know someone that will give you £30 for it. Lord God, £30 was a fortune of money in those days. A poor man wouldn't see the like of it together in his lifetime. Well, if you do, sir, I'd like to meet him, says Brian. Follow me, so, says the small lad, and he walked out in front of Brian, off along the road, the main road between Ennis and Tulla. They were only gone about a quarter of a mile when they came to a big old gateway, like the gates into a landlord's place. And the funny thing was, Brian didn't know it at all, even though he'd been walking that road all his life. But the small man, he stepped in between the piers and said to Brian, come on, your £30 is ready. So, Brian, he followed him in. He couldn't refuse that kind of money. Sure. And they went on, up along the avenue, until they came to the mouth of a tunnel. 'Twas dark, of course, inside it. And he got afraid. I'll go no farther, says he. You won't, says the small lad. You'd rather £8 than £30. All right, so. He turned, and off with him, into the tunnel. And do you think Brian didn't follow him? Indeed he did. £30 was a lot of money. But to follow him, that was the bother. 'Twas dark, you see, and Brian had the horse, leading him by the reins. He had to, even though he could see nothing in front of him, only hear the pitter-patter of the small lad's feet. And he was getting more afraid, but he couldn't go back. The tunnel was too narrow. He'd never be able to turn the horse. So he kept going. Then, after a lot of walking, up ahead of him he saw this light. A green kind of light. And when he came near it, there was the small man standing in it, beckoning him. The light was shining down out the roof of the tunnel. There was no windows there, or nothing. It was just shining down through the stones on the roof. And the small lad standing there calling him. Come on, says he, this way. They went on, down the tunnel, past the light, until they came to a crossroads. No, says he. He pointed to the left. Go down there and you'll come to a yard. You'll see three doors facing you. The one in the middle is the one you'll pick. Open that. 'Tis a stable. Put your horse in that stable. Take off the bridle and the reins. Hang him on the peg on the wall. Close the door after you and come back here to me and I'll take you where you'll get your £30 for your horse. So Brian did what he told. Went down the passage until he came to the yard and there was the three doors. So he put the horse in the middle stable, hung up the bridle and the reins on the peg on the wall, and came back to where the small lad was waiting for him. Now, says he to Brian, come with me and you'll get your money. Off they went back down the tunnel again, and down along in the dark until Brian saw more light up ahead. They came to another crossroads and turned left again, and the nearer they were getting, the brighter the light was getting until they came to a second yard. A big, big yard this time. And there, at the far side of it, was a castle with lights in every window up to the top of it. Come on, said the small lad. £30, remember? They crossed the yard and they went up three steps to the door of the castle. He knocked, and after a couple of minutes, the door was opened by this grand-looking girl in a long white dress. She smiled at him and welcomed him in, but what Brian was watching was her hands. Because she had rings on every finger. He never saw the like before. His wife at home had no rings at all. Even when they were getting married, they only had the loan for one for the day. She brought him into the hall anyway, and there was a carpet in it. Brian was tripping over it. It was so high. But if he was, no one else was, even the small lad. He couldn't understand it. They came to this door. In here, says the small lad. Brian was brought in. Now, said the small lad, how much for your horse? There was no one else there, only themselves. The girl was gone. Well, says Brian, you said £30, sir. And £30 it will be. Sit there, Brian, and I'll get it for you now. Brian sat in a comfortable chair. You wouldn't get the likes of it in a landlord's place. And the lad took out a key from his pocket, a small key, and went to the wall. Next thing, he opened up a door in the wall. 'Twas a safe, of course, but sure, Brian never saw the likes of that in his life. 'Twas a little use he had for safes. He took out this box that was inside it, put it up on the table, and opened it up. It was full up of gold. "Now," says he, "you'll get paid for your horse, Brian." And he started counting. 1, 2, 3, 19, 21, 28, 29, 30. "There you are, now all yours." You may say, Brian had to be told twice. He stuck it in his pockets as quick as he could, and he knew by the weight of it that it was the real thing. "Thanks very much," says he. My wife will be delighted when she sees me coming with this." "I'm sure she will," says the lad. "Why wouldn't she? But look, before you go, you'll have to have a bite to eat. You must be starved." And 'twas true, because all Brian had that morning before he started out was a cup of buttermilk and a crust of bread. Anyway, after being treated like this, how could he refuse the hospitality of the house? "All right," says he, "I will, and thanks." The small lad led him into the hall again, down and on to another room. When the door was open and he looked in, he saw the likes of what he never saw before. There was a room. 'Twas near as big as the field at the back of his house at home, and a big long table down the middle of it, covered with food and drink and gold and silver plates and dishes and cups. There was a chandelier hanging off the ceiling. 'Twas all lit up beautiful, and people sitting down at the table, and behind every chair there was a young person standing to attention with a kind of uniform on him. Servants, I suppose, and not a move out of anyone. Brian stopped at the door, looking in. "Go on," says the small lad. "There's your place." And he showed him where to sit. "I'll be back in a minute with your dinner." One of the lads with the uniform pulled a chair for Brian and he sat down, and off went the small lad and shut the door. By God, the more Brian was looking around him, the more he was thinking to himself, "There's something wrong here," because there was no sound, no move. No one was eating or talking or anything, and still, they were fine-looking people. But just when he was wondering what he'd do, he heard the door opening up behind him. He looked back, and there was the girl who opened the door of the castle for him. She hurried over to him, and just when he was going to say something, she pulled up her finger. "Shh," she says. "Listen to me. Whatever else you do, don't eat their food. If you do, you're doomed. You'll never see your home again." Before he could even get up, she was gone the same way, and the door closed behind her. Gave him something to think about, I can tell you. But he was only there a couple of minutes when he smelled cooking. He didn't know what in the hell it was, but it smelled good and getting better. Next thing, the door opened again, and there was the small lad, weighed down under a heavy plate. 'Twas huge, nearly as big as himself. You could barely see him behind it. He staggered across the floor with it, planted up on the table in front of Brian, and said, "Now, Brian, there's your dinner. You won't get better in Ireland." And 'twas true. Brian had no doubt about that, even from the smell of it. But he remembered what the girl said. And bad and all as Tulla was, he'd rather be there than stuck here for the rest of his time. "Well, do you know something, sir?" says he. "I've had so many strange things seen since I came in here that my appetite is gone. But thanks, anyway, I appreciate it." The small lad's face changed. "What do you mean? I'm not hungry no more. After all my trouble. Come on, Brian, eat it up. Look, I won't bother you," says he. "Thanks all the same, but won't I be able to eat whatever I like with this much money in my pocket?" The lad looked at him. "I'd advise you," says he, "eat now." There was poison in his voice. "Or if you don't," Brian stood up and looked at him straight in the eye. He was like a lot of Irishmen. He didn't like to be threatened. "No," says he, "I won't." And that very minute he refused the third time, everything inside that hall changed. The lights quenched, there was a crash of thunder and a flash of lightning, and by the light of it, Brian saw the beautiful young servants down along the table. were gone into ugly things like skeletons. And worse again, they were making for him, their bony hands reaching out to catch him. He did what anyone would do. He jumped out the way and made for the door as fast as he could, down along the hall, and to hell with the carpet, out the front door, jumped the steps, and ran across the yard like it wasn't there at all. Excuse me, one minute. He got as far as the tunnel, but behind him, he looked over his shoulder, and there, out the door of the castle, came things like skeletons after him, their bones rattling on the stones. He turned to the tunnel, nearly frightened out of his life, and tried to run, but he couldn't. He fainted, fright of course. Would you blame him? But just as he collapsed, the strong arms catching him up. He knew no more until he found himself back at the first crossroads in the tunnel. And there beside him, holding him, was the girl in the white dress. The girl who opened the castle door. The girl with all the rings. He looked up at her, stupid. What are you? Shh. She put her finger to her lips. Say nothing. Only go in there. Quick, quick. To where you left your horse. Leave him there. He's paid for it. But take the bridle and the reins and bring him back here. Hurry. And he did, in and out like that. When he arrived back, come on, said she. We haven't a minute to lose if we're to get out safe. Poor Brian had no clue what was going on, but he ran. He knew by the look of her that she was earnest. And when they came back to the crossroads and turned right, they kept running, off into the darkness, and never stopped until they came to the mouth of the tunnel. That's where she says to him, listen to me, Brian, and listen to me well. Do you see the avenue there in front of you? Go, run, as fast as you ever can. Keep the reins and bridle tight in your hands and don't look back. Whatever you do, don't look back. If you do, they have you, and there's nothing more I can do for you. Remember that, will you? And don't stop until you're out below on the public road. He looked at her, wondering who in the name of God she was, of course. Was she this world or the next? He said he would accept, but he couldn't until she told him who she was. Don't mind that, says she. Only go, while you're still able. You'd know by her voice that she was afraid of something. I will, surely, says he. Only tell me, why did you help me? And I, a complete stranger. How I ever rest easy if I don't know that? Go, will you? At once. They're coming. Listen. He did, and down along the tunnel in the darkness he could hear the sounds like bones rattling, which was coming near and near all the time. No, I won't stir out of this, says he, until you tell me who you are and why did you help me. He was a stubborn man. When she saw that he wouldn't stir, all right, says she, I'm your mother's grandaunt. I was carried by the good people here when I was 16 years of age, but I had no one here to tell me not to eat their food. I ate it inside in that big room and you were mine. I can never leave this place, but you can, but only if you go this very minute. Go on, I'll hold him back. The noise was only a bit away now, and she had to tell him again. He ran as fast as his two legs could carry him. He didn't look back either. When he came to the two big gates, he took one buck leap out between them like the devils in hell were after him. Out to the middle of the road. Was lucky, wasn't he lucky, that there was no traffic in them times? Wouldn't it be a poor story if he escaped from the fairies and be run over by a truck or a car instead? But when he gathered himself a bit and looked out from under his elbow, he got the surprise of his life because there was no gates and no piers. He sat up and looked around. Nothing, only the cows grazing in the fields. Just then he noticed his horse was gone. Horse, says he, I've been robbed. Where's my horse? He jumped up, but if he did, his trousers were near to fall down around his knees. What's this, says he, and he pulls his hands in his pockets. What came out? Only fists of gold. He went home to his wife, anyway. And she was surprised to see him back so early. Did you sell? Says she. I don't know whether or which, says he. All I know is this. And he emptied the money on the table. Now, says she, tell me, am I dreaming or what? He told her the whole story from start to finish. And you know what the woman said? The best thing we could do is go into the bank in Ennis and change it. Why, says he. Is it because you think I got it wrong? No, but I feel better about it. If the story you told me is true. Will you believe it is true? We'll go to town this very day, says she, and change it. And that's the very thing they did, into the main bank in the town of Ennis. I can tell you, tis very few times they were in a bank before that, and when they went to the door, they were stopped by one of the lads with the uniforms. Who are you looking for? Oh, the manager, sir, says Brian. He didn't know it at all, that was only the doorman they were talking to. The man looked him up and down, just like he was God Almighty. And what's your business with the manager? Have you an appointment? No, sir, but, well, then, he can't see you. He's an important man. That's the time Brian's wife took out some of the gold. That's a pity, says she. We wanted to ask her about this, but sure, we can always go somewhere else. Wasn't she a brave woman? The old manager was watching from the office. Behind the small window. Oh, they're clever lads. And as soon as he saw the gold, he was out the door like a hare full of old soft talk, like they were the nearest relations. Oh, how are you? And you're welcome. And is there anything I can do for you? And all that. They're terrible old hypocrites, the bank managers, you know. So he brought him into his office. No such thing as queuing up when he saw the money. And he sat him down. Now, says he, you're here on business, are you? We are, sir, says Brian's wife. 'Twas she that did all the talking, and just as well too. What do you give us for that, says she. She took out the purse where she had the gold and counted it up on the table for him. 1, 2, 9, 10, 18, 19, 27, 28, 29, there you are. And Brian, the fool, he was just going to ask her what she did with the last one when she gave him a kick in the shin under the table and a dirty look. And you think the manager noticed? Indeed, he didn't. All he was interested in was the gold. Well, says she, what do you give it for us? He weighed it in, and it nearly broke the scales. It was so heavy. Oh, tis worth £50. That was a fortune of money in those days. She only laughed at him. Weren't we offered twice across the street in the other bank? It was a pure lie for her, of course, but he didn't know that. We'll go back there now, Brian, says she. Come on, hold on, wait, says the manager. Maybe I waited wrong. Well, he knew, the thief, that he was getting a great bargain, even at twice what he was offering. They settled for £100, anyway. Sure, it was an unheard amount of sum for poor people. And when they came out of the street, Brian said to her, why'd you keep the last one? She only shook her head at him. Your mother didn't teach you much, did she? Or maybe you weren't listening to her when she was talking. Don't you know that if the good people pay you for something, you should never give all of it away? Do you want to insult them? Maybe you don't know that much, but I do. It was true for her, because after that, everything they put in their hands, it seemed to go right for them. As long as they had the piece of fairy gold, they were fine. Thank you so much. The book is called Meeting the Other Crowd by Eddie Lenihan, if you're interested in reading more fairy stories from Clare and other areas of Munster. Thank you. Thank you.
judge and think that you won't say goodbye.
Okay, the instrumental is getting on the stage, it's in a spooky box, which is what they mean. And it's a music instrument, and light work in temples in India, Bangladesh, as well by the Hindus or by the Buddhists. And it is an instrument of the Buddhists for meditatie en gebed. Maar het is ook een instrument met de hele toon. Dit instrument is gebaseerd op 432 hertz op de A-toon. Terwijl de beste synchronatie zou 440 hertz zijn. En het is maar een klein verschil, maar dat is wel het verschil tussen een hele toon en een gewone westerse toon. Ik begin net de meditatietoon D. D en G. En van lieverlee voeg ik wat klanken toe.
Thank you, Mr. Shiva, for the shooting box and for the drum. I didn't hear the name of the drum.
Sorry?
I didn't hear the name of the drum.
It's a brain drum.
Brain drum.
Brain drums, they are everywhere in the world, in all cultures. And some of them, they are made of animal skin. The drum is a frame drum. And this type of drum is used in all cultures for ceremonies and dance. They can be from leather, elaborate, decorated, or anything else. But the secret of the frame drum and leopard is a big drum that they use in the Indians or the Kodis. And local people with a big drum, with a sick man hitting the big drum. And it is proven scientifically that there is energy going up to the sky. And that's what you can do with the brain drum.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Thanks again, this evening, Diva. We have some more dialects coming up, but I think now at the moment we're starting to record your remarks.
Thank you.